Well, it'd be great if you've got a Bible with you to have it open at chapter Matthew 22, verses 15 to 40, or have it on your phone. That would be great. And we're looking at that title, Questions to Undermine Christianity. Most people, I guess, believe that Christianity is false, and that if you choose the right question, that you might be able to show that it's false. It might only need one question, they think. That killer question, that knockdown question. Perhaps you got into a conversation about God once, and maybe you've had this experience that the person you're talking to doesn't maybe believe Christianity, and they humour you for a while, and then you can sort of sense that question is coming. Aha, I've got you. You'll be stuck on this, and then they kind of hurl their question at you and probably don't leave you time to answer it before jumping on to see if they can find a better question that might work. And I think the idea is you're supposed to say, oh yes, of course, I never thought of that. You're absolutely right. You know, now that you mention it, I can see the whole thing is a load of rubbish and I'm going to give up on Christianity altogether. Some of the questions are good questions. Some of the questions are valuable questions and worth asking and worth taking seriously. Questions like, how can a loving God allow suffering? Or isn't the Bible actually quite anti-women and anti-gay and just not the kind of thing that a good God would want? Sometimes the questions are a bit more trivial. Like, what about dinosaur bones? Or who made God? Or some little difference between the gospel accounts of Jesus, which people think undermines the whole thing. And the question may be a good question. And if it's asked with a desire to find out if there's an answer, then that's a healthy thing. But sometimes you can sense, can't you, that actually it's not really about hearing the answer. Sometimes people are not interested in knowing if there is an answer because they assume that there can't be. And that, there seems to be this idea that Jesus and his teaching must be so weak and his followers so easily fooled that you just pick the right question. A well-aimed question will undermine the whole thing. Now, that was what was happening in the Bible reading that Pam just read for us. The people of Jesus' day are doing that with Jesus. They're hurling at him their questions. Now, we ask slightly different questions from them. And if you went trying to explain Christianity in a very different culture somewhere else in the world, they'd have their own set of questions. Ours are fairly predictable, and theirs were fairly predictable. But they throw their questions at Jesus. And they're sort of searching all through the passage for that killer question that's going to undermine Christianity. So here's how the... sorry, I'm having trouble with this today. Oh, interesting. We've gone to the end. Sarah, maybe you better help me with it a little bit. Do you want to just take me on to the next one? There you go. It works better when you do it. Then the Pharisees went out and laid plans to trap him in his words. You can see what they're trying to do. The Pharisees, there's two groups of religious leaders in charge of Jerusalem. Some of them believe what the Pharisees believe, others believe what the Sadducees believe, slightly different. And they went out, the Pharisees, they're laying plans, they're trying to trap him in his words. And they each have a go. The Pharisees send their followers, first of all, to ask a question about paying taxes, and that doesn't work. So then another group, the Sadducees, come along and ask a question about the resurrection, and they're silenced as well. And so finally they get together and they plan, and they think, who's our best guy? Who's our expert? They choose a lawyer. It's perhaps predictable they would choose a lawyer. And he thinks hard, and he comes up with a question that he really thinks is going to get Jesus. And of course it never works. There is no question that Jesus has difficulty with. And nor could they be. They call him teacher every time. They say nice things about Jesus, but they don't really want to be taught. They're not really interested in learning. They just want to undermine him and prove him wrong. And for the reasons why they wanted to do that, well, you can look back over the last few Sundays at the Bible passages and that we've done. Jesus has answers that work. That is the big thing, the big takeaway, I think, from today's Bible readings. Not so much what the answers are to those questions, but the fact that Jesus always has answers that work. And let's look at three examples from our reading of the questions and the way that he answers them. Firstly, Jesus answers the question about taxes by saying that we pay more willingly because of God. In other words, God's people can pay tax more willingly than if they weren't God's people because they're God's people, because they're his. Let's have a look at how that goes. Here's the question. Tell us then, what is your opinion? Is it right to pay the poll tax to Caesar or not? But Jesus, knowing their evil intent, said, you hypocrites, why are you trying to trap me? You see, they want, it is a trap. They want him to say publicly, no, we don't need to pay taxes to Rome, because then they'll get him arrested. And so they've been saying, look, Jesus, you're not swayed by anyone's opinion. You're not afraid of anyone. You're bold. You'll speak your mind. You won't mind saying in front of all these people that they shouldn't be paying their taxes. You wouldn't worry about a thing like that because you're devoted to God. And of course, there are people in the crowds who want Jesus to say that because they're against the Romans. I mean, they're thinking, look, if you really believe that God is king, you're part of God's kingdom, then why would you pay tribute to this other king, this Caesar? After all, he doesn't believe in God. He's a pretty nasty guy. He goes around calling himself divine. On the coins they had, it put Caesar, son of God. So how could a proper believer go along with that and pay these taxes and use this money? And the religious leaders, when they ask this question, they even bring along a little group of people called the Herodians, who were big supporters of the Romans. They were like the kind of collaborators, if you like. So that if Jesus says, don't pay the taxes, and they're standing there, well, clearly Jesus is going to get in a lot of trouble for answering this question. Jesus knows it's a trap. He says, you're hypocrites. You're not being sincere. You're not really asking a question you want the answer to. And he could leave it there. He's not been caught out. He's not been fooled. He could just stop and refuse to answer the question. But Jesus always has a good answer, and there is no situation that he would find difficult to deal with. And so here's his answer. Show me the coin used for paying the tax. They brought him a denarius, and he asked them, whose image is this, and whose inscription? Caesar's, they replied. Then he said to them, so give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, and to God what is God's. Jesus says, show me the coin. I mean, if they really believe what they're saying, they shouldn't have had one, but it turns out they have actually got one in their pocket, and they can get it out and show it to him, and it looks a bit like that. And he says, look, whose image is that? Whose picture is that on the money? A bit like today, you'd have a picture of Her Majesty the Queen, you'd have a signature from the Bank of England, and that's how you know it's official money. And Jesus says, notice he says, give back. He says, give back to Caesar what is Caesar's, because the money comes from the government. The money kind of run the currency, and they actually print the money and produce it, and they give it to you to use, and if they ask for some of it back, well, they're kind of entitled. They are in charge of it. Give back to him what belongs to him. But then Jesus adds a few more words to the sentence. It's very simple, but very powerful. He says, and give back to God what is God's. You see, just as the money has an image on it that tells you who it belongs to Caesar, so you and me, all human beings, well, Genesis says we're created in the image of God. So we are created by God, we're made by God, and we belong to God, and we're supposed to be like God and reflect God. So if the government is entitled to ask for some of its money back in the form of taxes, then God is entitled to ask for us, for everything we are and everything we do, to be given to him, to be devoted to him. So you see what Jesus is saying here. It's a great answer to the question. It's something that has got people thinking for centuries. The people listening to Jesus at the time write about it, and you see it coming up in Romans 13, 1 Timothy 2, 1 Peter 2, Colossians 3. Yes, you see, Christians, we are going to obey the authorities. But we're going to do that not because we're loyal to the authorities, but because we're loyal to God, and God wants us to. So we're going to give the authorities everything that we owe them. Yes, we owe them taxes, and we're going to obey the laws. I mean, even the kind of COVID rules that maybe we find a bit irritating because we think they're not strict enough or they're not consistent enough. Well, we're going to obey them because we owe the government our obedience. We're certainly not going to get into rebellion or terrorism or anything like that. We're going to participate. We're going to vote. We're going to keep to the speed limits. Christians are going to give the government what they owe. But the reason we're doing it is for God's sake, not for their sake. So it actually doesn't matter if they're a bad government or a good government, because we're doing it for God. And he wants us to. And so the only time that a Christian wouldn't obey the government is when the government are telling people to disobey God. Our only reason for doing it in the first place was to obey God. So if they tell us to disobey God, at that point, we stick with God. So, for example, in Acts chapter 4, the early Christians are told by the authorities to stop telling people about Jesus. And they say, well, who do you think we should obey, you or God? And they carry on telling people about Jesus and get arrested gladly. Jesus' answer, you see, is deep, it's profound. It's only a few words, but it has people thinking and writing books about ethics and philosophy and reflecting on it for thousands of years. It's made a huge impact on Western society. And we could ask ourselves, well, how many things have you said recently? How many things have I said recently that people will still find helpful and still be thinking about in 2,000 years? Jesus' answers are profound. Jesus has answers that work. That's the first one. Pay tax more willingly because of God. His second answer to the second question is about it's a question about the resurrection. Jesus says, expect more because of God's power. Expect more because of God's power. That same day, the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, came to him with a question. Now, these people don't actually, they say there's no resurrection, so why are they asking him a question? Well, obviously, to prove that there's no resurrection. They're not really interested in his answer. If it helps you to remember, someone explained to me, if you remember what the Sadducees stand for, this is why the Sadducees were sad, you see, because they don't believe in the resurrection. I enjoyed that. I know it's a bit cheesy, but maybe it will help you remember. They didn't believe that it was true, so they're asking in order to prove a point. And so what they do is they make up a really crazy story. It's really wacky. They find some little bit in the Old Testament law, Deuteronomy 25, where Moses says, look, if a man dies, his brother should offer to marry that man's wife. Because, you know, they're living in the promised land. They didn't want they didn't want the wife to be homeless. They didn't want the name to die out. They wanted that family to continue. And so that was the arrangement they had at the time. And the Sadducees say, well, let's suppose that someone is being very obedient to Moses. And there is this woman, and her husband dies. So she marries a younger brother. And then he dies, and so she marries another one. And he dies, and she marries another one. And he dies, and so it goes on until she's had a whole load of husbands that have all died. And then she gets to the end of her life, and she gets the resurrection on the last day, and there they all are in front of them, all of them. You imagine her embarrassment. Now, the first question that comes to my mind is, what has she been putting in their soup? You can understand, maybe, you know, it is a tragedy, isn't it? Somebody might lose a husband or two husbands, but when you've lost seven, it is starting to look a little bit suspicious, to say the least. Maybe when she meets them on the last day, they'll want to talk to her about the soup and say, maybe those mushrooms weren't as safe as you thought they were, and you should have spotted that sooner. But the Sadducees are asking a different question. What should she do? She's got all these guys in front of her. She's been married to all of them. She's reached heaven. Which one of them is she going to choose? It's almost like a kind of farcical situation comedy. You know, the awkwardness of your current partner meeting your ex-partner, but multiplied many, many times. They're not asking a sensible question. They're being really quite silly to sort of mock the whole idea of resurrection. But Jesus is not troubled by their question, and he's able to point out to them where they've gone wrong. Jesus replied, you're in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God. They've got two problems. They're meant to be Bible teachers, but they don't really know the Bible properly. And the other problem is they don't really believe that God is powerful. And he starts by talking about that second part. They don't really believe God is powerful. And he unpacks that. At the resurrection, people will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. Well, actually, the Sadducees didn't believe in the angels in heaven either. They didn't really go for anything resurrection. They'd managed to strip all of that out of the Bible. They'd actually reduce the Bible. They only believed the first five books of it. They didn't believe the rest of it was true. All too supernatural for them. So Jesus says, that is your problem. If you realize that God is powerful, surely any God who is able to bring people back from the dead is able to give us a whole new life that is so much better than anything we experience in this life, even marriage, and that is actually beyond our understanding and beyond our grasp, a bit like angels are. You don't see God's power, he says. And we might struggle with that thought because, you know, marriage is a wonderful gift from God, and it's something perhaps romance in our culture is slightly placed on a pedestal. That is where we're going to find all our contentment and all our fulfillment. And it's a good thing, marriage, but doesn't necessarily solve all your problems or put you into a state of eternal bliss. And Jesus is saying, don't limit your imagination and think that when you're raised from the dead, it can't be any better than this life. And it's just going to be what you've got now carrying on. He's saying, no, you're going to be, well, Jesus goes on elsewhere to talk about a marriage with God, where all believers are part of the same family and brothers and sisters, and where our love for God and our love for one another is even better than even the best love we've experienced in this life. Much more of a community, much more of a family, with no need to be exclusive or jealous or uncomfortable, but to be united in Christ. And you and I still need to believe in God's power, and still need to believe that God can do better than what we experience in this life. This is good news for single people. We don't need to believe the lie that really our lives are all about finding a partner, and that we can't be whole and we can't be fulfilled unless we've found that relationship. We don't need to believe that. Jesus says it's really only a taster. It's really only a hint of what he has in mind for the future. And something much better is coming. And it's great news for married people. There's no need to feel that pressure to have this perfect relationship. And that if the relationship isn't perfect in every way, then to dump that relationship and find a better relationship and find a soulmate that's going to bring you to paradise. It's Jesus that's going to do that for us. We can simply enjoy the marriage that we've got, that God has given us, knowing that we're destined for something even better. That's problem one. They don't know God's power. The Sadducees have another problem, and that is that they don't know their Bibles, though they should. Now, it's going to be difficult to convince the Sadducees from the Bible. If I were trying to do it, I've been preaching for quite a few years. I've preached to quite a bit of the Old Testament. I'd probably maybe go to Daniel chapter 12. It's pretty clear. There's bits of Ezekiel and Psalms, but the Sadducees have rejected all of that. They've chucked out most of the Bible. They're only hanging on to just the start of it. But that's not a problem for Jesus, because the whole Bible is consistent. He could prove his point from anything in the Bible, anywhere. And so he makes the point from Exodus, from Moses, hearing God speak at the burning bush. But about the resurrection of the dead, have you not read what God said to you? I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. He is not the God of the dead, but of the living. See, this is long after Abraham and Isaac and Jacob have died. And yet God says, I am their God. Not I used to be their God, and then I gave up on them and let them die. I am their God now. I'm still in that relationship with them of being their God. So how could they possibly be dead and gone? Surely that means that they must live on. Otherwise, how can God be their God? You can't be, say you're a parent if you haven't got children. You can't say you're an employer if you haven't got employees. And you can't be the God of someone unless that someone exists and lives on. Now, perhaps we've been led to believe that the Bible is full of contradictions. But Jesus is able to show that every part of the Bible has the same message and all hangs together. A friend of mine was telling me that part of the reason he became convinced about Christianity in the first place is that there were always good answers when he asked difficult questions. And he was overwhelmed not by how inconsistent the Bible is, but how consistent it is. Because when you think about it, written over 600 years, in at least three different languages by a dozen different authors in different cultures, and yet it all hangs together as one story with one message. Jesus has answers that work. Expect more because of God's power, he says, about the resurrection. And then thirdly, he says, obey more because laws express love. Let's have a look at the third question that Jesus is asked. Hearing that Jesus had silenced the Sadducees, the Pharisees got together. One of them, an expert in the law, tested him with this question. And it is a test. That word test is the same word in the original that we had in verse 18 where it's translated trap. Jesus said, you're trying to trap me. And they're still trying to trap him here by asking him, teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law? And now, why is that a trap? Well, as soon as you prioritize one law over another, you can easily be accused of saying that some of the laws don't matter. So you can imagine a child asking their teacher at school, tell us, miss, which is the most important rule in the school? Is it the one about running in the corridors or the one about not drawing on the desks? And if the teacher says, well, it's the one about running in the corridors, then they can say, aha, does that mean you're not really that bothered then, are you, if we draw on our desks? Or you report the teacher to the head said it wasn't such a big deal if we draw on the desks. Or a politician, you can trap a politician in the same way. You could ask them, you see this, don't you, I don't know if you watch politicians being interviewed or listen to them, but the interviewer will try to do this, and they'll say things like, so who do you think is the priority when it comes to vaccinations? You know, should we really be prioritising the teachers or the care workers or the police or the nurses? Should we be getting sort of all the older, more vulnerable people vaccinated with their second dose first, or should we be including some of the younger people who haven't been vaccinated? And politicians hate answering that question because a whole bunch of people are sitting there who are going to lose their votes because they're going to say, well, one lot is more important and the other people won't want to vote for them. But Jesus doesn't dodge the question. He doesn't squirm in the way that we would. He has a very simple answer, a brilliant answer. As far as we know, they debated this question a lot in those days. No one else came up with this answer, but as soon as you hear it, it seems obvious and compelling. Jesus has no difficulty saying what is the most important command. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Deuteronomy 6. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it, and this one's from Leviticus. Love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments. You see what he's saying? He's saying that the most important command is the one about your motivation, your heart. Every other law is really just an expression of that. The Bible is full of examples of what it looks like at that particular time, in that particular place. What would it mean for them to love God in that situation? What would it mean to love your neighbor in a different situation? But they're really just all summed up by that command. If you really love people, of course you're not going to murder them. You don't really need to be told not to murder them. You're not going to want to steal from them. You're not going to want to cheat on them in relationships if you really love them. If you really love God, you're not going to find it difficult to obey his command to have a one day a week set aside to rest from other things and to focus on him. It's not going to be difficult to stop idolizing other things in life like power or sex or money because you love God and you see that he is so much better because you love him and all those other things don't take precedence over him. So that's the summary of it. It all hangs on that. Jesus is very easily able to say which is the greatest command without in any way undermining any other command that God has given. So how will you respond? Jesus has answers that work. There are two ways that people responded at the time. Well, everyone's astonished. When they heard this, they were amazed, so they left him and went away. That's the religious leaders. When the crowds heard this, they were astonished at his teaching. Everyone's amazed, everyone's astonished. But some people turn away. If we were only ever looking for an excuse to turn away from Jesus and from his mercy and his authority, then it doesn't matter how good the answers are. We'll still do that. And sadly, so many people do turn away, often without even stopping to hear if there is a good answer. But there is another way. There is another way, and that is to stay and to listen. It'd be great to be thinking about people you know, not just for the Life Explored course, but other conversations that you could be having. And encourage people, look, if you've got a question, that is fine. Jesus will be able to answer it. Might take time. You might need to get to know him. You might need to read the Bible. You might need to find other Christians who've thought about that question and get them to show you where it says that, where how that is answered by Jesus. But Jesus has got answers. And he's got answers that work. And as Christians, we have doubts too. And I wonder if sometimes there's a part of us that is tempted to ignore those doubts. We might hear a question expressed by someone else, and half of us is thinking, actually, I have got a point there. And maybe we're tempted to kind of squash those doubts down, but really they just gnaw away and gnaw away, and we just want to ignore them because we're not sure if there's an answer. And it kind of eats up our confidence in Jesus, makes us more reluctant to talk about him or live for him, and a little less likely, a little less sure. But we can really be reassured that Jesus has got answers. There's nothing to be afraid of by raising a question. The only danger is to turn away from Jesus before he's had the opportunity to explain.